Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response in the day for the 6th of Elul. We thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hachhauser, for giving us the opportunity to share this year with you on their website. For the 6th of Elul, we are going to see Shut Minchat Shilomo Tinyana, the second volume, which really involves corporate volumes 2 and 3 of Minchat Shilomo of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's Chuvot, responsa. This is Simon Samach in that volume, responsa number 60. And as Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach does sometimes, this is actually a collection of many small Chuvot that he wrote up over the years, and then he put them together into one chapter. And it's my interest and excitement over having an opportunity to learn from Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, truly a great Torah giant, and very much a model of what Torah giants could be to Mori V'Rabbi Rav Lichtenstein Zecher Tzadik Livracha. My teacher, Rav Lichtenstein, admired Rav Shlomo Zalman with an admiration that could not really fully expressed in words. There's much to say about that, but that's not our topic today. So I've taken this, even though only one of the small sub-chuvot is dated to the 6th of Elul. We'll do that one first, just to make sure I get it, because it's actually number 18 in the list. We will by far not get to all 18, or to more. There's more than that. We won't get to all of them. We'll get to as many of them as I can get to, and it's Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, so whatever we get to will be beneficial to us. So number 18 happens to be on a topic that I taped this year early, so you're hearing this the 6th of Elul, and I'm taping it way before that. And I had just recently looked into this issue because it came up in another tshuva that we discussed, and a tshuva for the sometime in late Sivan, 29th of Sivan, that Tzitzit Eliezer was asked a question about doctors returning on Shabbat to their homes. And he had given whatever answer he had given. You can go listen to the tape for the 26th of Sivan if you're interested. But on the 6th of Elul of Tav Shin Nun Bet of 1992, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach responded to this question. Now he's an 82-year-old man by this time, so he's certainly elderly. And he answers this question. He says, I don't see any reason to take a step back from what I previously wrote. He says, in Minchat Shlomo Siman Chet, in the 8th responsum of Minchat Shlomo, that I see no reason how a doctor should be allowed to go back to his home, even if he's going to do, especially if he's going to use a Jewish driver, or do it by Jews doing melacha, if those are Torah melachot, if those are violations of Torah law. Now, we saw in that Rav Tzitzit Eliezer tshuva responsum, that there is a responsum of Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein assumes that a doctor can even violate Torah law to get back home after going out to save a life on Shabbat. Rav Moshe Feinstein's responsum is not our topic. My interest here is noting that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in 1992 is so convinced, and Tav Shin Nun Bet is so convinced of his perspective, he says, I see no reason to do it. And he says, especially if there's no worry about where he's staying, meaning if you're going to stay in the hospital, that's not pleasant, but there's no danger there. And if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, he says, in Tav Zayin, Seif Aleph, it says there that the only time you're allowed to go back, the doctor's allowed to go back, or those who have gone out to save lives may go back, is in terms of violating Tchum Shabbat, going more than 2,000 Amot. 2,000 Amot is a relatively short distance. So let's say somebody found themselves, you know, I was going to use New York City as an example, but all these things are very complicated because it's how we figure out how long 2,000 Amot is. It's all safer that the rabbi of a shul, my shul in Riverdale, is Rabbi Willig, had told me had shown me and lent to me, talking about Yerushalayim, where you can and can't walk in Yerushalayim, and eventually they decide that pretty much you can walk everywhere in Yerushalayim, even though there seem to be blank spaces of more than 2,000 Amot. So that whole calculus is very difficult. So whatever the answer is, but let's suppose somebody finds themselves outside of 2,000 Amot, but within 12 mil, within 7 or 8 miles, 6 or 7 miles, depending on how you figure out how much a meal is. So that would be a rabbinic level of violating Tchum Shabbat. That's what Shulchan Aruch speaks of. And also in Shulchan Aruch, Rav Shlomo Zalman says, it seems to be, it's only if you're afraid of where you are, meaning you go out, the example would be, let's say if somebody goes out to war and they win, you know, they repel the invaders, or they're marauders who are coming to plunder a city and there's threat to life, so they go to save lives, and then they are stuck outside more than, you know, they're stuck 2 miles outside the city, and if they just sit there all day, the marauders might come back and ambush them, so they're afraid. So that's an example of where the halach is clear, that they can go back, because they can go back, it's only a Tchum d'Rabbanan, it's a distance that violates a rabbinic prohibition, and they're afraid of where they are. That's the way Shlomo Zalman says he understands the halacha to be. Then he points out, there are those who've allowed, now the phrase is, they permitted the end activity, because of their beginnings. What does that mean? Their end activity is the going back home because they wanted to make sure that they would go out to save lives. So there are those, he says. He doesn't say it's from Moshe Feinstein, which is odd. I'm not sure that he knows that it's from Moshe Feinstein. He just didn't say it. He says, but there are those who have permitted it even on Torah law issues, like Tchumin, according to Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva in the Gemara holds the 2000 Amot is a Deoraita, is a biblical level of prohibition. So he would hold that way. That would be an example. And he knows of people who say that that's allowed and other versions of that that are allowed. But he says he thinks that if that were true, you would see it written up somewhere. And he doesn't know if it'd be written up somewhere, so he thinks it's not true. But what are we going to do, he says, because we can't, he says we can't allow ourselves, and this is Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who is a tremendous Torah scholar, and a daring Torah scholar in many issues. He, in his younger days, thought that many things about electricity could be handled differently than we handle them today, in a more lenient fashion. That wasn't the way the consensus of the Jewish world went. But he is not in any way a reflexive prohibitor of actions. He says, how can we say to ourselves, you can just allow malachot d'oraita, you can allow violations of Torah law? This is the thing I think is a big issue, comes up often. And I think it's a terrible question that we're not quite grappling with, where it's become clearly understood and accepted. So whatever the answer is, so he's saying here, he in this situation, in terms of returning home after saving lives, he doesn't know how we permit Torah violations of Torah law. And he says, but if you look at Shmir Shabbos Gilchitza, which is a book about the laws of Shabbat that Rav Yehoshua Yeshaya Neuvert, that's the name I couldn't remember, Yehoshua Yeshaya Neuvert did this remarkable sefer about the laws of Shabbat, and he did it in close consultation. That's the key point here. He did it in close consultation with Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He says, if you look at Shmir Shabbos Gilchitza, you'll see that if it's hard for a person to stay where they are allowed al yedei nachri to have a non-Jew, you know, get a non-Jewish car service, drive them ad 12 meal until you'd bet meal. Right? So he says he wrote that in Shmir Shabbos because I told him to write that. Right? I think that's true because it's a Durabbanan. Until 12 meal, we hold that until 12 meal, which is about, like I said, 5, 6, 7 miles, not five, it's like 6 or 7 miles, yeah, until then, we hold that it's a Durabbanan. So he's what Rav Shlomo Zalman is saying, if you want to violate Durabbanan of distance, he's really saying, but I think he might mean you can have him sit in you can sit in his car while he drives a car as well, which might involve some Doraita issues, but he's not turning on the car for you. Anyway, have a non-Jew do that. That you can do. But notice that's if you're not able to stay where you are. Im kashe lo lihisha'er. So he says, in terms of Durabbanan, since we know that many people, in fact, would refrain from saving lives if they had to stay, which is in itself, I think, something worth paying attention to. Rishon Zalman is implying, if I told the guy, let's say I'm going to become a doctor. So Rishon Zalman is pointing out that he thinks it's accurate to say that if Orthodox Jews knew that by becoming doctors, every time they had to go into the hospital on Shabbos for some kind of a situation would mean they'd have to stay there the whole rest of Shabbos, or they'd have to live somewhere close enough to a hospital that they could walk back from the hospital. If you knew either of those things were the requirement, people wouldn't go into medicine. Or they wouldn't go into versions of medicine where they might get called in on Shabbos. So that's a remarkable thing to say. I actually just had a contact with a doctor who told me that he had always made sure to live close to a hospital. Now, that's not always possible. It's legitimately not always possible, but it's an interesting question. So Shlomo Zalman says, so I did say you can allow if it's difficult, meaning not that you're afraid. That's the allowance here. The Shulchan Aruch speaks about you're afraid to stay where you are. Right? You're out in the open. The marauders may come back and ambush you, and it might be dangerous. Shlomo Zalman is agreeing in Shmir Shabbos Gilchitza that you can violate the Rabbanan by having a non-Jew help you do it, if it's just hard for you to stay there. So if somebody's going to live 3 miles from the hospital, or it's 3 miles, they can really walk, but let's say it's 3 miles to a bad neighborhood, or it's 4 miles, 4.5 miles, whatever it is, they could have a non-Jew drive them back. That's what he said he thinks you can do, as a follow-up to the Gemara's giving in to accommodate those who are saving lives. So that, he says, I have a basis for. But to violate Chil Shabbos on a Torah level, Al Yidei Yisrael, so that he has a very big problem with. This is a contrast to what we've seen before, but I think an interesting contrast to think about and raises all these sorts of issues that we don't always notice. So that is the tshuva from the sixth development. Now this is a long chapter within Minchat Shlomo. That was the 18th responsum. I'm going to jump right now and I'm going to finish up the ones that I have towards the end and then go back to the beginning of the tshuva. The 29th responsum in this list of responsa was about smoking on Yom Tov. He says that when the Rambam writes in Hilchot Deot, let's remember the Rambam starts off his halacha book with a section called Sefer HaMada. It's really about broad life lessons in many, many ways. It's about philosophical issues, some of it. It's about Torah studies, but all sorts of broad issues that affect the overall character of an observant Jew. And one of those is Hilchot Deot, which is the laws of character, of how we build the right kinds of people want to be. It's an innovation of the Rambam's a little bit that include that as strict halacha. It has some basis in Rashi Gaon, some basis in Chovot HaLevavot, who wrote his whole book to make sure that we understood that there are obligations that have to do with just how we shape ourselves internally, but that's a different discussion. So in Hilchot Deot, the Rambam writes, Yesh ma'achalot ra'im biyoter, there are foods that are bad for you, and a person shouldn't eat them, right? So that's, he's saying, theoretically, should be true of smoking. So the verse of Zalman says, Mikol makom, if somebody wants to smoke and they enjoy it, so then it's considered ochel nefesh. But that's not smoke. He says, if somebody wants to eat those foods and eat them, so it's at least ochel nefesh. So let's say I said to you, you know, red meat is a very bad example. Sorry, I apologize. Let's say there's some other food, cakes, that are very bad for you, right? You get one of these confections that has, you know, 10,000 calories in a serving, and it's very bad for you. So on Yom Tov, however, if you wanted to bake that, it's still considered ochel nefesh. Why is it considered ochel nefesh? Because it's food. But that's all in foods. For some of Zamed Varbach, here it says, smoking is not a food. And therefore, you would need that to be a davar hashaveh lechol nefesh. It would have to be that everybody enjoys it, everybody finds it satisfying or whatever, before it would be allowed. And he seems to be saying, he doesn't say it straight out, but he seems to be saying, he doesn't think one can smoke on Yom Tov because it's not an act of ochel nefesh. You're violating prohibitions of Yom Tov, I think, mostly in terms of lighting fire. You could say that, but I think you need a davar hashaveh lechol nefesh. You need something that is commonly acceptable to people as a vehicle of enjoyment, and since that's not true of smoking, he seems to be thinking already in Tufshin and Bet in 1992 that maybe it's not allowed to smoke on Yom Tov. There's one more tshuva at the end there that we can get to if we have a chance, but I want to get back to the beginning of the tshuvot of this list. So he talks about Birchot Kriyat Shema. This is number 3 in the list of tshuvot. The person writing him had suggested that when the Rambam writes that somebody who isn't sure if they said Kriyat Shema, let's say, you know, there are a lot of ways you can just not remember. So in the morning, it's a little hard not to remember whether you said Kriyat Shema because you hopefully davened, and in the course of davening, you said Kriyat Shema. At night, again, hopefully you said Marv, and that would say Kriyat Shema. But let's suppose somebody's not sure they said Marv, or they know they said Marv, but they said Marv too early, right? That can happen. Marv before it's time for Kriyat Shema, and therefore they don't remember if they repeated Kriyat Shema. That would be a good example of where one could have an honest, legitimate doubt about whether they said Kriyat Shema without us casting too much negativity on them. The Rambam had written that the person should say it again. So that is because it's a suffix d'oraita. It's a doubt about a Torah obligation. So we usually say when you have a doubt about a Torah obligation, if there's not some reason not to do it, then do it again. So you say Kriyat Shema again. There's no downside to say Kriyat Shema again. But the Rambam writes, and you also make the bracha before and afterwards. So the brachos before and afterwards are, we would think, a derabbanan. Well, not we would think, they are a derabbanan. They are a rabbinic innovation. And therefore, you would have thought not to say them again because maybe you did say them the first time. The letter writer had suggested for Shlomo Zalman that would be only according to the Rambam. The Rambam happens to have held that when Chazal created these brachot, they made them inherently connected to Kriyat Shema. It wasn't that these are brachot that are good to say, and it happens to be the place to say them is surrounding Kriyat Shema, but they're a separate idea. It's that Chazal sort of reconfigured Kriyat Shema so that in Chazal Judaism, Kriyat Shema involves the passages in the Torah of Shema plus the brachot. Whereas the Rashba holds that the brachot are a takana bifne atzma, that they're their own ordinance, their own legislation, their own innovation. So according to the Rashba, if that's true, meaning they said, yes, there's a mitzvah, so they say Shema, and also there's a rabbinic obligation to say Brachot Kriyat Shema. According to the Rashba, this letter writer, this man asking the question, the Rishon Zalman said, how could the Rashba think you would repeat the Brachot of Kriyat Shema? Because that's a rabbinic issue, and since you have a doubt of rabbinic issue, we usually don't repeat rabbinic issues if you have a doubt about them, especially on things like Brachot, where we try to avoid needlessly invoking using Hashem's name. Which Shlomo Zalman points out that, as logical as that might sound, if you look in Shulchan Aruch, it sounds like, when Shulchan Aruch rules this way, if somebody's not sure if they've said Kriyat Shema, they should say the Brachot over again as well. When they're repeating Kriyat Shema, it sounds like everybody agrees. It sounds like the Rashba doesn't disagree, that the Rashba's disagreement about the nature of the Brachot Kriyat Shema applies elsewhere. So why would that be? So the Rav Shlomo Zalman says, if you look in the Kesef Mishnah, it sounds like the Kesef Mishnah, working off of Rashba, says that the takana was, it may be a separate takana, maybe a separate legislation, but the legislation was that in any situation where we're going to advise a person to reach Shema, we're going to say you need the bracha with it. So it may be a separate or not separate legislation, but whenever it is that halacha requires this person or ordains this person should say Kriyat Shema, the bracha go along. So that's one tshuva about the nature of the connection, the extent of the connection of Birchot Kriyat Shema, the brachot of Kriyat Shema to the Kriyat Shema itself. And the conclusion is that whenever somebody has to say Shema, they should have to say brachot with the Shema that they're saying. Second tshuva that we're going to deal with, throughout, not second at all, we've already dealt with a few, but the fourth in the list is from Tufshin Mem Hei, from 19, presumably 85. Question is, do you say Tefillat HaDerech on the road from Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim? That's, to me, a very interesting question, because by Torah, by rabbinic law, in the Kedina, the Gemara, the way the Gemara has it, when somebody leaves a city and they go a quarter of a mile outside of a city, which is 500 amot, so that's about 1,000 feet, a fifth of a mile outside of a city, and they're on the road, they say Tefillat HaDerech. So certainly Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim is a long enough distance that you would think you'd have to say Tefillat HaDerech, and yet Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, I think the Gamrei Potter, you don't have to say Tefillat HaDerech. Why don't you have to say Tefillat HaDerech? He says, because we don't say Tefillat HaDerech until the halacha is, until there are two parsa'ot. A parsa is four mil. So a mil is 2,000 amot. An amma is between 18 inches and 24 inches, somewhere between a foot and a half and 2 feet. So 2,000 amot, a mil, is somewhere between 6/10 and 8/10 of a mile, right? 3/5 and 4/5 of a mile, about. So multiply that by four, right? So it's either 2 2/5 miles or 3 1/5 miles. Somewhere around there is a parsa. So two parsa is six and a half miles about. Somewhere around 6.5 miles without habitation. And you have to be going in the wilderness. You have to be going on a road where there's nothing there. So how you define another place is an interesting question, but the Rishon Zalman says, thank God, it's settled Tel Aviv to Yerushalayim. When you drive the road to Yerushalayim, you're passing places that are all settled. Now, he says it could be that in the places where there are Arab, where the only settlements are Arab, and he writes, I think it's a beautiful phrase, Ho'il v'cha'et heim oyivim. Since right now they are, I mean, that's 85, sadly I'm not sure that it's changed too much, but it carries within it the hope and the recollection that we don't think of them as inherently our enemies. We think of them as, sadly, right now, our enemies. Now, once they're enemies, you have to do whatever, you have to respond to enemies the way you respond to enemies. But that, v'cha'etim oivim, right now they're enemies, so then you might require to think of that as a makom lo miyushav. So if you had, all along the road, 6 miles, two parsa'ot of Arab habitation, so someone's saying, yeah, it might be that there you'd have to say a tefillat HaDerech. And when evaluating this, he says, by the way, when you're evaluating how far you have to go, he says it's two parsa'ot. The accepted custom is to think about it by distance and not by time of travel, meaning two parsa'ot. If I'm walking, I might have thought to myself, well, if I'm walking two parsa'ot, if I'm walking about 6 miles, let's say it's, 15 minutes a mile, 12 minutes a mile, 20 minutes a mile, so it's an hour and a half walk, an hour and a quarter walk, 2 hour walk, so whatever it is, right? That would be a Tefillat HaDerech element. But 6 miles in a car on a highway is 5 minutes, 10 minutes, right? So I might have said to myself, now that we have cars, we don't have to say Tefillat HaDerech for such a short travel. It's a logical claim, but Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says he thinks that the accepted custom is that we judge it by distance and not about time. So as long as somebody's going to get on an intercity highway where there's no settlement between the cities, if there is a settlement, there are always people around, then you have a thing. But let's say if I think about the New Jersey Turnpike, I feel like there are times when you drive the New Jersey Turnpike and around you there's no yishuv. There might be built. I think it's a hard question today as to where you would or wouldn't say Tefillat HaDerech by that standard, because you need to have empty space, and there's not so much empty space as there used to be, but there are places. Certainly there are places. Many, many years ago, I was on a highway in the middle of the night called Deer Walk Highway in Ohio, like rural Ohio. It was very scary. Anyway, that was certainly a Tefillat HaDerech kind of a place, but not so simple. But he says it's about the distance, not the amount of time. Then he says, nowadays, with the roads, and there are other cars on the road all the time, and there's usually police supervision, moving police, there are like police patrol cars around, he's not sure whether you should say Tefillat HaDerech principally at all, he seems to say, and therefore he thinks maybe you should always make it without without using Hashem's actual name, right? Because we try to avoid making brachot necessarily, and he's not sure about it. But that's a chiddush. It's a new idea. It's a novel claim. He's not sure that it's true. As a follow-up to that part of the tshuva, he says, what about when you're traveling for a few days? Right, so what do you do about Tfilas HaDerech? Right, I'm going on a road trip. I'm traveling from New York to Seattle. It's going to take me 6 days, or I'm traveling from the north of Israel to the south of Israel, but I'm stopping along the way. So I stop overnight and I visit and I sightsee and I learn and this and whatever. Or I'm hiking, yam el yam, from one end to the other, or from the north, whatever I'm doing. I'm traveling for a few days. How many Tfilas HaDerech do I have to say? So he says, if you stop traveling at night and you sleep somewhere, even if you sleep in the open, you might have thought, if I sleep in the open, I'm still traveling, right? Yeah, I understand. If I stop at a hotel, I'm not traveling anymore, and therefore I've stopped. He says, no. He thinks that anytime you stop for the night and sleep, the next day you make another Tfilas HaDerech. But if you travel day and night, like or on a ship, for example, now this is an interesting question, because he points out the Mishnah Berurah Paskins, then you'd have to, you make a bracha every day, unless you're not continuing. But interesting to me, let's say you're on a cruise and you put in at port and you stop, so then it seems like you'd need a new Tfilas HaDerech, although it might be only when you stop overnight. But he says that because people are doubtful on this question about whether or not you make a new one every day, the custom is that in Birchat Shema Koleinu, in Shmoneh Esrei, on such a situation, you would say Tfilat Derech in Shema Koleinu, because Shema Koleinu ends in the same way that the Baruch of Tfilat Derech ends. The Baruch of Tfilat Derech ends, Baruch of Hashem Shomei Tfilah, and so too, the Baruch of Shomei Tfilah ends that way, so therefore you can just stick it in there, and it's not a problem, because you're not adding an extra Baruch, and you might as well. So that would be a good way to solve that problem. Response number 9 in his list is Birchat Shechiyanu B'Leidat HaBat. Let's say your wife gives birth to a girl. So with a boy, the reason why it's different is with a boy, you're going to have a bris. So all the brachos and celebrations you're going to make in the situation, then you're going to have a bris, you're going to have this. But the Mishnah Berurah says that the first time you see a man sees his new daughter, his baby daughter, he should say Shechiyanu. Right? You thank Hashem for the great gift of the daughter that you've had, because it certainly says, and his point isn't that it's comparable to this, his point is that it's not comparable to this. It's nowhere, it's at least as good as seeing a friend after 30 days. You see a good friend after 30 days, you make a Shechiyanu. So Mishnah Berurah says, so you should say Shechiyanu, seeing your daughter. So Shlomo Zalman says, but he's not sure, because he thinks that the brach of Shechiyanu comes with knowing somebody and with being familiar with that person. So for most people, the first time they see a child, their child, they don't quite know that child. Meaning, if I brought somebody, I'm in the nursery, I'm the nurse, and I bring a new father, his baby daughter, he holds her for 2 seconds, I bring her back to the nursery, and then 5 days later, I bring out a baby. Would that father really know that it's not his daughter if I brought out a different baby? So Shlomo Zalman's point is, he doesn't know that you know your daughter yet that way, and he thinks it might be that you make the Shechiyanu once you really sort of get to know the daughter, and you really get familiar with her, and she becomes your baby in a real way. So I think that's an interesting approach and recognition of the important parts of the bracha. And then he says, but let's even say, nope, there's something special about the first time, you should make the Shechiyanu the first time. Let's say the guy doesn't make the Shechiyanu the first time. So the Shulchan says, what about the second time? Would you make it then? Because then you don't have the advantage that it's the first time, and you still don't know her well. So Shulchan Zalman doesn't paskin, but he seems to lean towards the idea that the Shechiyanu should come when the father sort of gets to know his daughter better. She's in the house, it's been a day or two, he's already really sort of gets a sense of her, then you make the Shechiyanu. Okay? Now, when it comes to response number 10 in our list, so the Shutar Tzur, Tzipesach Frank, had said that he thought that a woman who gives birth shouldn't make a gomel, because why shouldn't you make a gomel? Because the nusav of the bracha of a gomel. So let's remember, a gomel is, let's say, when somebody gets out of danger. Many people today still say it for air travel. And the bracha, it reads, that gomel chayivim tavot, sheg malani kolto, that Hashem gives or repays those who are chayavim, who really are liable for more, for worse than they got, and Hashem gives them good instead, and thanks Hashem for doing that. So that makes sense. For example, another example for a gomel is somebody, God forbid, is ill, seriously ill, and the definition of seriously ill is an interesting one, but somebody seriously ill, and then they come back to health, thank God, they make a gomel, they thank Hashem for it, right? So the point of the air travel, or is dangerous travel, they were in danger, there were problems in their travel, or they were in jail, and at a time, there was certainly a time when going to jail was inherently dangerous because the government wasn't clear about when you'd come out. It wasn't like there were fixed rule of law situations for getting out of jail. So getting out of jail was the time you make a gomel. So that version of the bracha said Rabbi Yitzchak Frank, when he says l'chayavim, it's because there's usually some suffering involved, and it's the end of the suffering that we're thanking Hashem for, because we're saying, oh, if I suffered, this is an idea that sadly that many people try to reject today, but the idea of the bracha, which Frank was saying, is if I've suffered, it implies that I needed the suffering, that I was liable for suffering, and I sinned, and yet I'm doing better, and thank God that Hashem didn't exact from me the punishment I would have deserved for my sin. But when the woman giving birth says, Frank, that's not what it is. Now, we all today, I think, commonly assume that women who give birth to Hagoma because they were in a situation of danger. For some of what Frank was trying to say, but that situation of danger has no implication of sin to it. And he was suggesting, Frank was suggesting that the bracha of Hagomel Chavim Tovot came for danger and danger that came with suffering that wasn't natural, that was because if it's not natural, we could say it's this person's sins that played a role in bringing this situation. That's what he said. And therefore, the woman who gives birth, she's not done anything wrong. She's done a very important thing. She's done a wonderful thing. Therefore, as Rishon Lezion said, I don't think she'd make a gomel because she's not a chayavat in that sense. So Shlomo Zalman Moirbach says, I don't understand if that was the standard, and Rishon Frank is older, is 35 years older than Rishon Zalman Auerbach. I'm pretty sure he would have known him and met him in Yerushalayim as the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, but he's comfortable saying, I don't understand what he's talking about. Because the strong tradition was that somebody went on a sea voyage, who took a boat somewhere, would make a gomel when they came back safely from that sea voyage because it was dangerous. Rishon Zalman says, but there are plenty of people who take sea voyages who are doing a mitzvah. So the suffering of being on a sea voyage isn't anyway connected to their possibly having done sins that would make them deserve worse than they got, and yet they'll come back and they'll make the bracha hagomel, and they'll say hagomel chayavim tovot. They'll say that exact formula. So why shouldn't the woman who gave birth have the same formula? So he says he thinks it's something else. In his society, apparently, married women who gave birth didn't make hagomel in general. Sorry, women who sadly miscarried didn't make hagomel. Women who had problems in their pregnancy didn't make Agomel. And that was, it seems to be, from this tshuva, more of what Frank was trying to deal with. And he was saying, yeah, you don't have to do that because it's all part of life. And Shlomo Zalman is saying, he thinks that's not what happened. What he thinks happened is, it's a matter of tzniut. Tzniut was, and I'm not saying, he's not, I don't even think he's saying, that tzniut meant this is what has to happen. But in many communities, on times gone by, women didn't commonly come to shul and thrust themselves into the public eye. But the recitation of Hagomel is thrusting oneself into the public eye. Now, there were times in communities where the husbands would say Hagomel for their wives. So that would avoid that issue. And then, theoretically, you would have assumed that somebody whose wife miscarried would also do that. However, it could also be that you didn't want the whole world to know that she miscarried. There's no reason why the whole world has to know it. And therefore, you wouldn't make that Hagomel, and that would fit in with the tzniut idea. So why was a woman who gave birth different? So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, because women who gave birth, relatives would tend to come to the house to celebrate. So once they're already in the house to celebrate, the woman in the house, the mother, the new mother, is there, she can make Hagomel, so she did. And there were those, as he says, who had the custom to come to shul, but they would come to shul to hear Baruch Hu, because they wanted to hear the laning, and then they had an opportunity to say Hagomel as well. But with a mapelet, somebody who miscarries, so it's true, if there was a Beit HaMikdash, she would have to bring a korban, she would have to bring a sacrifice, as a new mother would have to bring it, if the pregnancy progressed beyond a certain point. But since there's nobody going to come, right, you don't have big gatherings of relatives to even to commemorate a miscarriage. The truth is, not that it's in the truth at all, but the truth is that's something that sometimes women who miscarry, or even more sadly, or more difficultly, more painfully for them, women who have a stillbirth, so that lack of a communal gathering, of a social gathering to provide support, is often something that bothers them. But in the context of our tshuva and our response to him, it's relevant because he's saying that would be why, if women didn't tend to go to shul, they would not say Hagomel in that situation. So he thinks that actually in these situations, the bringing of a korban tovah is only reshut because it's not an obligation, because they're not in exactly, I think he means, because they're not exactly defined as being in the same kind of danger to their lives if it just went all okay. If there was specific if there were specific complications and they really were in danger of their lives, then they would presumably have to bring a kotoda. But if it's just a regular woman who gives birth or sadly miscarries, you know, especially gives birth with no complications, no problems, he doesn't think there's necessarily a requirement of giving a korban toda. And that would mean there's not necessarily a requirement of saying Hagomel, but if she wants to, she can. And if you look in the Magen Avraham, he says he thinks also the Magen Avraham seems to treat it as a reshut, as something that's her choice, but not a requirement. As I said, we're going to get to all these things. I don't actually have time, but I'm going to just do one more because I feel bad leaving the ones that we're going to have to leave. So one more is number 16 in this list of these responses from Shut Minchat Shlomo Tinyana. If you want to look it up yourself, it's in the second volume, which really volumes 2 to 3 together. Simon Samach, response number 60. Number 16 in the list, Shlomo Zalman talks about taking medicine on Shabbos. The tradition in the Gemara was, we don't take medicine on Shabbos because in the time of the Gemara, they were worried that medicine was very often ground by private people. They were worried that if you ran out of medicine, you would grind new medicine, and that's a violation of the Torah, so they didn't take medicine. So how you deal with that today when nobody grinds it anymore? It's all a question of its own, but that's not the question here. It's clear in the Gemara, in the Halacha, that somebody was ill, and I think the standard in Shmiras Shabbos Kehilchos says somebody was ill enough that they would be bedridden, they would have to go to bed. If they're that ill, they're allowed to take medicine on Shabbos. So Shlomo Zalman says, it's clear to me that let's say somebody knows that if they don't take their medication, they're going to get ill, but they're not yet ill, but they're going to get ill. He says, clearly they can take that medication, because why would we have to wait till they get ill? Right, there are people who need medication. Without medication, they can get ill. That medication is the same thing. Now, I think he means it's got to be medication that if you don't take it, you'll get ill enough that you'll have to go to bed, but you'll have to be bedridden. But he doesn't quite say that. But he says if you need medicine, otherwise you'll get sick, you can take the medication. Now, there's a Radvaz who says, let's say a Jew is somewhere where he can't get his medication. The Radvaz says you're not allowed to tell a non-Jew to go bring the medication for you. Shlomo Zalman says he thinks that must be in a situation where it's not clear the person will get sick, but it's clear they'll get ill if they don't take the medication. He thinks the Red Vaz would have to be, because he says, if you look at the Red Vaz says there are people who don't, meaning the Red Vaz case was actually food. He says there are people who don't eat and they don't get sick. So the Red Vaz is talking about a situation where he's not convinced, right? Sometimes somebody will say, well, if I don't do this, this will happen. Sometimes you're not convinced of it. But there are plenty of people for whom it's very clear, if you don't take this, this is going to happen, right? You know, I think it would be an interesting question. Let's say if you don't take your blood pressure medication one day, is it going to raise your blood pressure to the point that there's a real danger of stroke? Could be. But there might be other people for whom one day isn't such an issue. And then if they could take their medication, if they stopped them and didn't take their medication on Shabbos, would it be a threat to their life? So that's an open question. But that's what the Rav Vaz was talking about. The Rav Vaz says, maybe they won't get sick. So the Shlomo Zalman says, but if it's clear they would get sick, he thinks the Rav Vaz would agree. But he doesn't, but he says, but vitamins aren't like that at all, right? Vitamins isn't something that, it's not a food, right? You can't say, I'm just taking it as a food. And it's not a thing that if you don't take it, you're going to get sick. So therefore, he thinks it's generally, unless you have a doctor who said about this person, there's, you know, somebody has such a serious vitamin D deficiency that if they don't take vitamin D every day, they're going to get sick. So then vitamins would be in the same way, but that's because then it's really a medication. But anyway, ultimately, he says, and I think this is something I once said to somebody, they didn't believe me, but he says, but really it should be an avoidable problem because almost all these medications are one-a-day medications. If that's true, take it Friday just before Shabbos and take it immediately Motzai Shabbos. And sometimes you have medications that are more than once a day, then you would still have these issues and you talk about the questions. But with the once-a-day medications, that would be a solution to the problem that would make it not even have to be an issue. So those are some ideas of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's, starting with one of them coming on the 6th of Elul, allowing us a chance to learn from him, thanking the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hochhauser. I will tell you all and hope for you all that you have a great day.